What's up, y'all? Welcome to the Sports Medicine Broadcast, episode 99, in-season shoulder conditioning with Ron Johnson. Bubba Wilson and Bill Hale will be doing the interview. The first part of what you're hearing is a lecture from the 13th Annual Sports Medicine Update. Thank Bob Marley and Memorial Hermann for allowing us to come there, record, have all these great interviews all at one time. So Ron Johnson is a physical therapist in Shiner, Texas. He's going to tell you more about that in the interview. Ron is always a fan favorite. He's great at demonstrating and teaching. He's got lots of great ideas, and he's really on the edge of what he's doing there for physical therapy and his athletic training, his athletes. We are looking for people to rate and review the Sports Medicine Broadcast on iTunes or whichever podcast app that you're using. So again, we're really looking for those ratings and reviews so that we can improve, but it also helps other people find us. So please go to iTunes, rate the Sports Medicine Broadcast, leave a review, and then I will do my best to put those, to read those, mention those, give you a shout out, as long as it's civil. So, you know, if there's something we need to improve, let us know. Of course, sportsmedicinebroadcast.com has a comment section where you can comment there or on Twitter. If you like it, share it with your friends. But what we're focusing on right now is comments on iTunes. So sportsmedicinebroadcast.com. Check out the schedule there. We got some really cool stuff coming up. So I am the host of the Sports Medicine Broadcast, Jeremy Jackson. Hope you enjoy Ron Johnson's talk, and thanks for listening.
What a wonderful opportunity. I say always, the blessing is mine to be here and share with you guys. And I learned so much from being here, the camaraderie. Something I certainly miss is the fellowship with other therapists, with other athletic trainers that don't quite get to Shiner. So where the heck is Shiner? If you're heading towards San Antonio on I-10, about halfway there, you hang a left at Flatonia. And so we're a little off the ways that way. So we're about an hour and a half from San Antonio, about an hour and a half from Austin, and a couple hours from
$5 for the quarters?
Here from Houston. Yeah. like to say that still, out there in Shiner world, the Houston doctors that I had the privilege of kind of growing up with as a physical therapist are still my main referral sources. If I added up, my Houston doctors are beating out, you know, my Victoria, local doctors, Austin, and San Antonio. And so what is still a wonderful blessing to work with these top physicians. That's because of the trainer outreach program we have. And I tell you, Bob Marley is a legend in my neck of the woods over there. So he goes as far as Salisbury, which is 15 miles down the road for me. So still what a wonderful blessing. So my talk today, in-season throwing routine. All right, in-season shoulder conditioning program. So really, I'll go over the objectives here, but it's kind of a share with what's going on in more recent literature, what evidence-based practice is, but how do we implement it in the real world? Provide an avenue for you to be a part of the solution in helping solve and reduce these number of throwing arm injuries out there, so we know that's true and we can all be a part of helping reduce those. Present the needs for and benefits from strength and conditioning programs for baseball players. You know, in the past, it was a little bit taboo, and we didn't know why we were doing stuff for baseball players, but maybe share some things there. Present in-season strength and conditioning principles, okay, for baseball players. Present special considerations for the throwing arm when you're developing this in-season strength and conditioning program. And some of this stuff, and it's good that it does, kind of piggybacks on things that Russ shared yesterday in his talk on internal engagement. So I think it's plenty okay to reiterate some of the things that we know on the throwing arm. Present a plan for practical implementation of an in-season strength and conditioning program. So it's just a little bit more geared to what you might do in the school setting, not in the rehab setting, but what we're doing in the real world with your athletes and maybe how that can fall into place and what you want to do with baseball players. And a lot of kind of FAQs and FYIs kind of built in there along the way. All right. So, really, let's go to some definitions of strength conditioning for baseball. We're going to focus on the power and strength development. This is kind of what would be a baseball program comprised of. Multi-joint exercise selections for power and strength. So I don't think it really should matter if you're a golfer, if you're a football player, you're volleyball, basketball, baseball. There's still basic strength needs that we have to get through basic strength exercises, including a progressive resistive exercise program. going to follow a year-round periodization plan with the baseball players. We're going to consider the special needs of that personal, that player himself. And so we'll look at their certain shoulder characteristics, their postural characteristics. This is for you guys that are familiar with the functional movement screen. Awesome place to put that into practice. And one thing we'll also share today is a thrower screening that I think is kind of puts together what we know right now and maybe get a little bit of a useful format for you. But also with our program designed for a baseball player, we want to make sure we're including proper arm care, rotator cuff scapular strengthening and stabilization program. Really like that Dr. Crumby said this morning, emphasis on deceleration, postural balance, two or three to one ratio of push to pull. So we're working our decelerators and our eccentric control muscles. And also we're looking at special range of motion, mobility, flexibility issues of the thumb arm and the hip. So we got some things we can talk about the hip. Great, let's get after it. So really, what's the purpose of it in season? So we're going to narrow it down to what we're doing in season with our baseball players. Injury prevention number one, manage your throwing arm symptoms, because we all know we have symptoms of the throwers throughout the year. So nobody never gets through a season without a little fatigue, a little sore arm, a little stuff like that. So we'll see how we manage that. And we're still looking to enhance our performance. And maybe take one step forward and make sure we're maintaining the best we can the gains we met in the off season, and still make sure we get it in season. And what it's not, it's extensive, progressive strength and conditioning program. I think that's sometimes where we kind of get off track. You know, we get through the fall sports, the winter sports, and now it's baseball season. And oh, great, now it's baseball season. Let's do it. I got this great baseball program we can do. And we pull out a sheet, and it gets all encompassing. At that point in time, it's too late to kind of get that route and that exercise program going. We think of the number one causes of throwing arm injuries tends to add to be the additional volume that these guys are throwing. So it's number what the research said in even 10-year follow-ups is number of innings thrown, number of pitches per game, number of months per year thrown, throwing through fatigue, the things always come up. And so what we don't need to do while they're going through the baseball season, all of a sudden, let's throw on a whole bunch more shoulder, arm care work that they don't need to be doing right now when they're building up pitch volumes during the season. So it's something we need to do off-season. All right, here we go. Components of this in-season program. Yeah, I'm going to talk about off-season screening. Arm care included in the off-season strength and conditioning program. So if we're not going to do a whole bunch of stuff in the season, then we got to do it sometimes to build it up in the off-season. So you need to know what that means, what that would entail. And then what's some specifics of in-season arm care? All right, let's get after it. An ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. We know who said that. The trivia there. Ben Franklin. So off-season screening, that's one of the handouts I gave you. So that kind of compiles what we know to be true about our predictors of arm injury, range motion issues, strength issues, and the throwing arm and the hip. So
I don't have anything.
Compile that to achieve the screen and look for it. All right. Was there a previous injury or surgery, shoulder, elbow, and hip range of motion issues, strength issues, scapular mechanics, right? And also we need to talk about probably maybe put together functional movement screens. All right. So this GERD issue. Russ talked about it last night, and so now it's pretty common knowledge what we're talking about with the throwing arm range of motion issues. GERD, glenohumeral internal rotation deficit. A pretty good study that's all-encompassing is one Wilkin, American Journal of Sports Medicine, 2011. So we're kind of coming to a conclusion on what all this really means. All right, but this study right here, three-year GERD study. So they did it with a professional team, all right, over 3 year force rate. And yes, a significantly higher number of players on the DL with GERD, 1.9 times higher rate. So it's a real deal. It's a real deal. Significant range of motion loss, what they calculated, where's the cut even point? 12.9 degrees. So 13 degrees or more of a loss of internal rotation on the throwing arm side versus the non-throwing arm side is kind of a cutoff we've got to do something about. Total motion concept. All right, so that's adding on external rotation plus internal rotation and comparing side to side. Those should be similar. All right, so similar that within 5 degrees is our cutoff point for that one. 13 degrees for internal rotation, but only a 5-degree window for a total range of motion concept. Right? And if you fell without that 5-degree range, 2.5 times higher rate of injury, right, in those guys. And then if we combine those together, if you had a total loss of range of motion greater than 5 and internal rotation loss greater than 12.9, 3.5 times greater risk of injury. Wow. So big deal. So we can catch that in our screen. One thing that probably doesn't get as much play, it is more recently, so we talked about internal rotation complications. Russ talked about last yesterday. Loss of horizontal adduction. Interesting study. So even I was a part of it back in 01. And Wilk has correlated that, and there's been some other ones as well. Even though it had a loss of internal rotation, there was not a loss of horizontal adduction. So interesting. So we still need to see that there's a normal side-to-side balance of horizontal adduction. Myers, 06, they were able to correlate that there's loss of horizontal adduction was seen in pictures with the internal impingement. So we do something about it. What about the hip? Okay, so we know hip's important for a lot of reasons, but we can correlate it to arm injuries. Loss of lead hip internal rotation. Okay, so the lead hip is the front hip, your land, your stride foot. Okay, when the front foot hits the ground, we should still be able to maintain some of our hip internal rotation. Alright? If we're not able to maintain hip internal rotation and our trunk has to open up, right, because we can't stay closed on the front side, then all of a sudden that's going to cause problems. If we're opening up, flying open, then that leads some issues in the trailing thumb arm. So what we see, a loss of lead hip internal rotation compared side to side, 5 degrees or more, shoulder at risk. All right, so there's some follow-up studies on that. But if you have loss of lead hip internal rotation, your thumb arm is in jeopardy. Increased hip passive range of motion, so just being flexible, period, allows a lot of things to happen in the thumb arm motion. Pitching velocity is correlated with pitching velocity, trunk separation velocity, how well he can stay closed on the front side, so this coil is happening even more so. He can open up the front hips and still stay closed at the back side if he's got good mobility within the hips. Pelvic orientation and stride length both related with hip range of motion. So kind of one of the buzzwords in the strength conditioning world is, you know, having good hip mobility, you have to be able to release the hips. So we know that it's important. Great. Scapular kinematics, scapular humeral rhythm, something we look about, so we always talk about how important it is, and Dr. Crumby did this morning well, scapular kinematics. The problem with the scapula is what? It's a big bone on the rib cage, right? So it's not a good bony landmarks, and the problem is, too, is people can do a whole lot of funky things with their shoulder blades when they're actually in the mood, especially if you tell them, I'm going to look and see what your shoulder blade is doing. Right. So we don't have a lot of good reliability tests, but here's one that's we're seeing more and more in the literature. It has been reliable. It's in the Journal of Athletic Training 2009. Right. So you take the weight, 3 pounders for someone less than 150, and a 5 pounder if you're way above the 150. And we just do 3 reps of flexion and 3 reps of abduction. And because we can't come up with anything very particular and be reliable, you just have these broad categories. You can grade it, normal, subtle abnormality, or obvious abnormality, or you can talk about weaning. Right? Those definitions on your thumb screen right there, kind of what that means. Alright? So that's about as good as we get. And there's more still, we know how important that is. Intuitively, we know we got the scapula's got to be where it needs to be to allow proper fundamental motion to occur, but there's still not a lot of conclusive evidence on exactly how we measure that and how we correct it. All right, FAQ, I heard, or read, that baseball players shouldn't lift weight because they don't need to. Well, we know for sure in our strength and conditioning world that strength improves a whole lot of things. Muscle strength, power, aerobic endurance, on and on and on and on. And we can see that improved strength in all these studies also improve vertical jump, throwing velocity, sprinting speed, running economy. Sure, those are all qualities we want in our baseball players. You know, 15, 20 years ago, certainly beyond that, We thought it wasn't good to be lifting weights as much with baseball players, but I think things have turned around. It's just not as common of a question we see in our parents when they're concerned about the little Johnny playing lifting weights when they're playing baseball. Alright? Well, they don't need to, but it's also dangerous. Isn't that lifting weights dangerous? There's not a lot of studies there's a lot of injury rate studies for sports. Number one sport for injuries for the shoulder, football, wrestling number two, and then kind of further down the road is baseball. Alright? But not many of them will compare injury rates that throw weightlifting and weight training in there. But this one did. And we see, this is done in the UK, so we have rugby, soccer, all those things kind of up there at the top, and way down here on the bottom, weight training, weightlifting, okay? So this is per 1,000 participation hours. I mean, per 100 participation hours, so the research does not back that up, that it's dangerous, okay? And here's kind of what my thoughts are, is that if you think lifting weights is dangerous, try being weak. Being weak is what's dangerous. Alright, so just my thoughts. Sure, weightlifting is important. Well, let's don't get too far off course and say that it's all important. Okay? So I'm going to go over the 80% rule that we need to spend most of our time developing our sports skills. Okay? Let's don't take away from what we need to do on the practice field. Because we're going to try to do all these special exercises in the weight room. And so we got off track sometimes on these functional exercises, mimicking sports, but then you get out there and do the sport. That's the most important thing. But 10% of that time, spend strength and conditioning. All right? And then another 10%, you can do whatever else you need. You know, if it's kind of rehab type stuff, if you have specific concerns or needs, and that's probably where you spend there. So let's don't get down the wrong track of we're going to make you a whole lot better baseball player by just what you do in the gym. You've got to be on the field practicing, working mechanics, and getting repetition in. All right. Well, the other question is, so they're lifting weights, but they're just doing all that football stuff. Well, really, well, what is football stuff, and why is that so bad? We'll talk about a little bit later how we would modify some of these lifts. But here's an interesting study. So this is done in 04. Say you look at shoulder strength. They were going to measure it on internal axial rotation, isokinetic dynamometer. So they did a shoulder study group that just did internal axial rotation. So maybe I should do a little bit more than that. But they did progressive loading on internal axial rotation. And then the other group did kind of football lifts, right? General strengthening. Pull-ups, lat pull-downs, overhead press. Oh my gosh, overhead press. Pull-ups, push-ups, all that. Well, dadgummit, which group improved their shoulder strength better? The group that did the general lifting, not the group that did internal axial rotation lifting. So we're talking about what's the best way to strengthen our shoulder. Maybe it's not doing that. It's just getting flat out strong. Interesting. Alright, and I was at a professional baseball athletic trainers society meeting a couple years ago. They held it in Arlington. So a good time to go to the PBATS meeting, and it's a great course. They usually hold it in the winter at different cities, and the pro team and that city will host it. But anyway, so this is what was up on the board at the Texas Rangers stadium. So this is their off-season program. This is not in-season stuff, but wow, look what they're doing. High pulls, push press, squats, split squats, cleans, deadlifts, lunges, bench press, incline bench, pull-ups, push presses, hammer curls, all these things. That's what the big leaguers are doing, right? And our parents are worried that our kids are doing a little squat and it's gonna mess them up for baseball. Alright, does it improve velocity? So I'll run through some of the stuff. This is kind of that FYI stuff. Heck yeah, it improves velocity. So all of these studies in a lot of different modes prove that doing some work improves your performance. This one, so which one is the best? Well, so this researcher, Green, in 01, tried to categorize these workout programs. General resistance, special, and specific resistance. What are those? General resistance training is kind of stuff we talked about. Doing real lifts, get your full body strong, and throwing some shoulder stuff along with it. So 7 out of 10, yeah, that improved their velocity. What about the special resistance? This is kind of power. If they're just doing ballistic type stuff, plyometric training, even some Olympic lifting, grade 4, improved velocity. What about special resistance training, specifically? So just kind of mimicking throwing motions to bands and tubing and weighted and underweighted baseballs, 13 out of 13. Yep. So we got lots of ways we can improve the performance by working out. This one's done more recently by Escamilla. She's part of the SMI group in Birmingham. So they did three different programs, kind of more current stuff going on. The Thor's 10. If you guys have likely seen the Thor's 10, that's been out a long time. So that's basic dumbbell and tubing stuff with the Thor arm, and includes elbow and wrist type stuff as well. Kaiser pneumatic. And so those are those hydraulic pneumatic kind of machines. And their program, they did kind of full body, kind of chops and lifts, and also did some kind of D2, D1 pattern type stuff and interrotation. And the third group just did plyometric training only, so medicine ball stuff, explosive medicine ball stuff. And so this was a 6-week program, 3 times a week. They looked at velocity pre and post. All three of them improved velocity, but there was not one that was significantly better than the other. So they didn't say, this is what you got to do. So basically, it comes out with all these studies, doing something kind of smart is beneficial. Well, so if we're looking at strength, we need to be strong. This was a study in over a 5-year period with major minor leaguers. When they did their preseason screening, they looked and see what was the correlators or predictors of shoulder surgeries. This is kind of significant stuff. Right? So people that were weak on these three measures in particular, external rotation by the side, scaption, and external rotation at 90 degrees prone, those guys that are weak in that, significant correlation with those guys requiring surgery. They were weak. Maybe we can tease those guys out in our preseason screening and say that's important. We found those guys and we need to get them stronger. Alright. Lessen the pain if we do some strengthening in season conditioning type stuff. Well, only one study has looked at that. And this one was in 98, so they did 8-week strengthening program, one group was a control, and then they went out and threw 60 throws, okay, and they looked at pain scales. That's all those pain scales. And a day, 2 days, or 3 days later, and the group that did work out had significantly less pain. So it helped with performance, helps with the pain, and likely reduces the risk of injury. All right, principles, strength and condition. For in-season, we want to maintain what we've gained in the off-season. Our volume needs to decrease, our intensity tries to stay fairly high. So you just can't do as much, we still need to get them to work hard to maintain what they did. All right, because we still need to avoid overtraining. So we can't give them some all-encompassing workout program, like I said earlier, because we've got a lot going on in season. And then we still need to make prioritizing baseball skills to be the baseball skills. All right, not let anything else get in the way of what we're doing on the field. This is a nice little study, and I've done it for other sports as well. So it's a survey of the professional coaches that have NBA, hockey. And we've done it, and this one was for Major League Baseball strength conditioning coaches. 70 of them participated on it, 70%. This is just a survey study. This is what they did in season. All of them did strength training in season. This is kind of the things that were different. 62% of them did twice a week training, and then some of the other ones did 3 times a week. One or two did 4 times a week. The most common length of session was 30 minutes. And then some of them are doing 45 minutes, so that doesn't include the kind of warm-up stuff and the stretching they said. Almost a third of them are doing Olympic weightlifting. Interesting, we thought that was taboo. Order importance, so they were asked to list up the top 5 most important exercises they were doing. Squat, number 1. All right. Lunges and its variations, number 2. Lat pull-downs, number 3. Dumbbell rows, number 4. And then some rotator cuff type stuff. Okay, so I'm kind of taking consideration as to what they're doing in various cities. They have weight rooms at all the other venues for them to work out at. And so some of it is just typically predicated on what's available to them. As you can see, leg strength, our pulling muscles, we talk about decelerators, and some cup work. All right? So it's kind of where they broke it down to most important. So I think that's important to kind of take home with them. And just like I said, volume stayed kind of low and kept intensity kind of high. And a couple of them did kind of a periodization schedule. They got a little bit less sets of reps as the season went on. Well, is 2 days a week enough? This particular study said, well, I guess so. So they did a 12-week base, they had a preseason strength and conditioning 12 weeks before the season, and then they broke them into different groups. They did a one-day training a week group, twice a week training, and then one control group that didn't work out. All right? So over the course of the 12-week season, they found no significant difference between lifting once a week or twice a week when they retested the strength at the end of the season. They were significantly better than the no training group, but one and two is about the same. So at least working out once or twice a week is enough, is sufficient enough to maintain your strength. And here's kind of, and this is Eugene Coleman's strength and conditioning. This is what their in-season program is when he's with the Astros. So kind of a general strength and conditioning program. They go three times a week with full body exercises, and they also have a shoulder, wrist forearm, and gripping technique additionally to that. So that's kind of what they're saying is good for their arm care situations. Grip training. So I think it's, at least what I like to do on this is kind of FYI, I like to incorporate, you know, grip training in with the shoulder strengthening stuff. So instead of just doing dumbbell work, we can kind of be creative and say you can use the different weighted balls, the squishy balls, sand bells, and so they have to grip at something, so I got different weight grips. I like fat bar training, so if they're doing stuff, then we got the fat grips, or even just tape up some bigger things when they're doing. So I think it's a good way to not have to add on exercises, but you can do it with some grip training along with your shoulder. All right. So we're still, and we'll be able to kind of finish up some of this if we need to in our kind of breakout sessions. The assumptions that we're going to kind of go follow along with, we're saying, here's our in-season program. That they're already doing the general strengthening program, you know, in their athletic period. With their other coaches. And so what are we going to do? We can kind of add in our modifications or specific needs or details for the individual athlete. The good thing now, and this has developed, you know, over the last handful of years here in Texas, it used to be football was the king, and you did football, and football was only, and nothing else mattered. And your strength and everything was predicated around spring football and everything there. But now, being baseball is such a big deal, and it's such a big deal to so many of the parents, that I think coaches and administrators are forced to kind of pay attention to what their needs are and the says, and the baseball coach has a lot of clout on campus now as well. So that's a good thing. All right, so components of our in-season program, we're going to have to modify the general strengthening conditioning program. Ideally, you know, I like to say ideally always to protect the shoulder, but in-season, I think certainly, and if someone's having symptoms, then absolutely so. We need to make our modification suggestions. We want to include some arm care stuff along with their workout program, and then also talk about what a post-pitching routine might be. All right, modifications. Okay, so this is kind of, certainly kind of symptomatic. So what are we talking about? So squatting sometimes ends up being an issue. Should baseball players squat? Well, I think definitely Major League Baseball players put it. Coaches put it as number one on our list, the most important. But you can do some type of safety bar squat. But the problem sometimes with squats is this extreme external rotation and extension of the shoulders get put in. So sometimes that is irritating, especially the anterior shoulder, or maybe a posterior impingement, especially if you're doing kind of a low bar or powerlifting kind of squat. So some type of safety bar squat. This one's actually called a spider squat. I don't know if you can see it. So it's got handles in the front, so he doesn't have to support there. It's all supported across the mat. All right. Or maybe just a hex bar or a trap bar deadlift instead of something where you have to rack it on your shoulders. If they're doing Olympic lifts, maybe if they have a little kind of iffy elbows, wrist type going on, then we're still going to get the explosive benefit of an Olympic lift if we just do a high pull and just don't rack it. All right. Bench press. We can go to dumbbell bench pressing so we can modify the depth of that descension phase and also find a better spot to put our elbows in so we're not in that kind of 90, high five danger zone with the shoulder. I like this one. It's called a Swiss bar or a football bar. So you can kind of see it there. So it's got a lot of different angle grips on there. So similar to what you do in the dumbbell, we can load it up a little bit more, but be safe with our hand placement, okay? So we can be a little bit more neutral grip, a little bit more narrow grip, so we don't have to get out in that spot if we're doing some sort of a bar lift with it. So that's a fun one that guys like. Alright, inclusion of arm care. Alright, so the way we have it, at least at the school I work with, is one day is a dumbbell day, and then the other day is a band day. So they're lifting twice a week in season, and not a lot of extra lifting, right? They talk about, again, these are my thoughts, we don't want to overtrain these guys. They're going so much now that we don't need a big, long, extensive workout program. And I'm talking one or two sets of 10 to 15 reps, where I'm looking at quality of reps versus just cranking out a bunch of reps and fatiguing it tough, and we don't go to failure, and all of a sudden they're in arms fatigue from their rehab session, right, or their in-season conditioning program. And one thing, you know, I like it, it's kind of fun doing it on a Swiss ball, or when they do it in the weight room, they do it on benches. But let's go get past the fact that someone's having an issue doing it correctly, so it does require a whole lot of kind of stability and control. I mean, don't be afraid to stick them on the bench and just do one-arm stuff, because they can focus that much better what they're doing scapular-wise and arm control-wise, okay? But certainly I do that early in the rehab process in the clinic setting, but for strength and conditioning world, still don't be afraid to get them down to just one-arm. All right, and so the other day, they're doing a band day, and so there's many different band routines out there, and there's one been proven better than the other, not really. Our evidence doesn't say so, but we still want to get good cuff, good scapular stabilization in what we're doing, okay? And this is my little fella, so we actually, and this brings on the other topic of my thoughts, doing band, a lot of band work at practice or pre-flowing band work. I think it's okay if we just consider it what it is. It's kind of an active warm-up. So we're doing light tubing with just a few reps, 10 reps maybe, so we're doing just like we do for the rest of the body parts, getting a general warming of the specific body area, increased blood flow in the area, kind of get their muscles kind of wake up and activated, woken up and activated for the phone sessions to follow. But I would never do an extensive tubing routine out on the field where the cuff is fatigued and they're going to ask about the throw. We know the problem is with the throwers already that they're overdoing it in that sense. All right, so we got to talk about shoulder and elbow flexibility issues, okay? So let's talk about this. But elbow-wise, stats say that the throw and elbow, we have a loss of elbow extension, okay? And that's normal. Okay, even a loss of elbow flexion. But we still want to see that that's not getting worse as the season progresses. Alright? And so we're going to keep an eye on that. Actually, the research says it doesn't significantly affect the throwing motion until we get to a loss of 25 degrees. Because your ball release, when our elbow's not extended all the way anyway. So it doesn't really have a major effect on your mechanics, but we don't even have a flexion contraction. Reinhold is kind of a hallmark study. Significant decreases with the after pitching. This was seen after 24 hours. Loss of shoulder internal rotation motion. Total rotation loss. And loss of elbow extension immediately after throwing. So I think that's an important time that we get after their stretching, so it doesn't have a cumulative effect over the season. All of a sudden they have this inter-rotation or total rotation loss that's outside of that safety window that we talked about. So, great study here. This is just in last December. Wilk is kind of all-encompassing. It kind of does a good review of where we're at in the world of inter-rotation, GERD, horizontal adduction, and where we're at on the sleeper stretch. Well, so modified sleeper stretch. The problem with sleeper stretch is what? It kind of puts you in that impingement position. But we still, if we're going to find a way that these kids are going to stretch on their own, then we can safely do that. So instead of being on top of the shoulder, I think it's okay to bring their shoulder a little bit underneath, so they're still stabilizing their scapula. And this is a lefty from Victoria, but we should probably have them lean back a little bit more. They're not up on it as much as what we maybe initially were teaching these guys. And then you put a little towel under there, so that can kind of enhance a little bit more lateral scapular stabilization and a little crossbody stuff. We still watch for symptoms right there. And then we can also modify the crossbody horizontal adduction stretch. Still stabilize the lateral board of the scapula, not directly on the shoulder, and then we're doing that iFMGE stretch and rest of the pose. Alright. In an FYI, I'm kind of studying, so we know that long, prolonged static stretching has been shown to decrease, you know, explosive performance in running and jumping immediately following on a static stretching program. What hasn't been proven with the Thorn arm. So if it's okay to include a stretching program before one throws, and it had no effect on average velocity, maximum velocity, or accuracy, but doesn't seem to have a carryover effect in the Thorn arm. Alright. KFAQ, should I ice after I pitch? Alright, there's a question. This study done in 2013, topical cooling delays recovery from eccentric exercise-induced muscle damage. This is actually a baseball player that did bicep. And so they looked at, they did MRIs on these guys at zero, right at the time after the exercise, 3 hours, 24 hours, 2 days, and 3 days afterwards, and looked at kind of the makeup of what was going on in the muscles, and the ones that did ice still had continued signs of muscle damage, right? Muscle damage markers seen in those ice subjects versus those who didn't ice, they didn't have a sign of muscle damage. So they were cleared of this eccentric overloading damage a lot faster than this ice group did. And so their concluding sentence was topical ice delays healing. It delays the healing and recovery of these eccentrically damaged muscles. Now, we're not saying that an injury or a sprained strain or something acute, a little trauma there. We've been seeing ice does better, but if we're going to maybe extrapolate that the Thorn arm, which is eccentric overload stress and typically the problem, then icing may not be the magic bullet that they need to have after Thorn. Alright, so this one is the only study that kind of looked at trying to put together a post-Thorn routine. And that was O3 in the Journal of Sports Medicine Physical Fitness. So they looked at shoulder range motion measures and cross-sectional area. They did some MRIs after a throwing session. Okay, so broke up into four different groups. They did a control group, they did an ice group, they did a light exercise group. In this study, it was actually a UBE, upper body bike. And then they also did one with light exercise plus ice. Okay, so they did all those markers after throwing session. And the one that significantly recovered faster, the range of motion and the swelling that was seen in the MRIs, the cross-sectional muscle area, the ones that did better, the ones that did light exercise and light exercise plus ice. Those are significantly better than ice groups than doing nothing. There was no significant difference between the two. So they didn't say ice was bad, but ice didn't have an improved effect over somebody that did light exercise. So you take that, you know, as meaning that you don't have to ice or it's okay to ice, but it looks like we need to do a little bit of a cool down type exercise as well. So what would that be? Post-Thorn routine at the game, some type of light tubing, right? Again, light tubing, modified sleeper stretch and a modified cross-body stretch like we already talked about. Easy enough. And the way we do it over at St. Paul in Shiner is the day following, the pitchers come see me at the clinic in the morning before school, and this is kind of the routine I use. Do the foam roll stretches, kind of full body stretch. I think it's a good time to get a hold of them and do some postural things as well. Always do some thoracic kind of self-mobilizing type stuff. I see that would be a big problem for the guys. Some active soft tissue mobilization, so I include those areas that got eccentric overload, and they're where we end up having loss of motion. Posterior shoulder type stuff, and even elbow type stuff. So we want to make sure we're going to regain our internal rotation, cross-body stretch, elbow extension, range of motion, and also, oh, by the way, let's make sure we're working on the hip. Lead hip internal rotation member is important. All right, that's kind of what we look at, and we'll probably, this is one thing we'll maybe go over in a breakout session, the foam roller stuff, thoracic mobility type stuff. And these are the components that we get to really get our soft tissue type work in posterior shoulder. Also, soft tissue stuff with the elbow, and then we go ahead and do our internal rotation, cross-body stretches with scapula stabilized, and work on leadership and orientation. This guy's a lefty, and so I like to use a belt as well, so I make sure we're getting proper joint mobilizations while we're doing interrotation stretches. And all that takes 20 minutes, tops, 15 minutes, try to get it in and get out, and then feel a whole lot better about it. And then I also add in just a little bit of strength stuff, just enough to do it. And I like doing manual resistance stuff so I can kind of get a feel of how they're doing and where in the range they might be having issues. And easy to do. And then maybe a little bit of band stuff, exercises that they're actually not doing with their dumbbell routine in the weight room or the band stuff that they're doing on those other 2 days. Not overload them, just a little bit of something. All right. So like Bob said, they'll have the full handouts and the presentation will be available to you guys. Email me if you have any questions. You need me to send you stuff and the kind of order of information. So articles, graphs, maps, charts, all that kind of stuff. I got it. We'll get it by to find it somewhere along the list for you. So I appreciate you kind of hanging in there with me. And others, the question type stuff, we can make sure we can cover now, but we'll kind of run over stuff in the
breakout session. Cool, thank you guys. Welcome back to the Sports Medicine Broadcast. I'm Bill Hale, athletic trainer at Preston High School. With me is Bubba Wilson, renowned specialist from Memorial Hermann, and we have athletic trainer Ron Johnson with a lot of letters behind his name, man. Ron, can you, before we get started talking about in-season shoulder conditioning that you talked, you just got through talking about, can you give us a little history on you and all those titles?
Well, I don't know what all those titles really mean. I like to tell, you know, here's the truth in the patient world is people don't care how much you know, they just want to know how much you care. So then it ends up being meaningless to them, so it's fun working with patients. I guess my background is as a baseball player. I grew up with my dad as being a college baseball coach. I played college baseball, so it was kind of fun for me. I started my first job, and the way they had it kind of delineated at the clinic is it was a sports medicine place, and you were either shoulder guy, knee guy, ankle, foot, and ankle guy. And the first day I showed up, I was told I was going to be the shoulder guy, which is kind of how it ended up being. And then I kind of had fun working in the baseball world and kind of found a little niche in therapy and athletic training with the baseball folks.
Let me guess who told you you were going to be the shoulder guy. I know exactly.
Yeah,
who it is.
So.
Well, you were talking about in-season baseball conditioning, and you talked a little bit about off-season first, the importance of the strength training and preseason screening. Can you kind of talk a little bit about that?
Right, so kind of what goes on in season is kind of all for naught. We're fighting an uphill battle unless we've done something to prepare ourselves for in season. So, you know, the evidence is out there saying if we have significant loss of interrotation in the shoulder, we have loss of bosonic induction, we have weakness in the shoulder, I mean, that has been proven to be possible deleterious or leading up to injury. So we catch those guys in the off season, we can do something to remedy it, and then all of a sudden we're lessening their chance of having injury in the season. So I think it's huge that we do something prior to the season and not wait till we already have problems in the season.
Hey Ron, you and I have known each other a long time, and this is kind of our, you know, combined passion of this stuff right here. We've talked about a lot of different things over the years. Have they looked at, and I'm sure they looked at anything with just elbow extension and any loss of that? Does that play a part at all? I mean, I know some of it's adaptive in nature from throwing, but if you lose it, a significant amount of that, does that change anything?
No, actually doing my research and background checks on the talk, there was only one study out there and said, actually, no. So they didn't come up with any deleterious effect of you having loss of motion in the elbow. I mean, loss of shoulder motion and even loss of hip motion has led to even elbow problems, but the elbow itself, not really.
Really, it's almost an extra stabilizer in a way. So, yeah, okay.
Okay, well, that's interesting. I could just listen to Bubba talk on, because Bubba's like talks about baseball more than I do. I mean, baseball was key, but I didn't play baseball, so... just looking at my notes here, you were talking about, I mean, it's a lot of this you can go and listen to. You reiterated about making sure the core is very high point, and I keep stressing that with the baseball players and all athletes about the core. Can you talk about the importance of the core in relation to, like you talked about, the internal rotation of the hip and how the explosion or how the hip explodes, that how the hip ties in with the core?
Yeah, that's a good point. So I think, you know, 20 years ago, baseball players, we just looked at the shoulder and the elbow. And then we had this revolutionary idea that the rest of the body matters too. So the core is kind of all-encompassing. Depends on who you talk to. Some people say that's just the abdominal stuff, but we're talking about here. That includes all the scapular stabilizers and what's going on in the hip and trunk. And so if the hip and trunk's not mobile enough, if our trunk's not stable enough, then there's no way that the forces can properly be transferred onto the rest of the body, and it's left with putting overstresses on the shoulder and elbow. So some of their mechanic faults very likely are mobility, flexibility, strength issues. Not, and the poor fellow can't get things right just because he doesn't have the ability to get it right, not because his coach is teaching him wrong or he's not trying hard. So maybe we can pick up some of those physical needs and help him out.
So therefore, athletic trainers, we should really stress towards the baseball coaches the importance of the whole body.
Right. Every coach, every sport.
Yeah, every sport.
Yeah, I think coaches are clued in on that right now. And I meant to mention all this, but the good news now is that coaches know this stuff. And baseball coaches, they go to the conferences and courses, and they hear everywhere they go, there's at least one or two people that kind of give a medical side, transcription side of it, so they know it. But their problem is going back and implementing it. They go back, and they got a million things to do, and far down the list is trying to do a little bit of a baseball screening or something. So us as athletic trainers on the spot, they would love, of course, to help them out on it. I think more than what we realize, if we approached the baseball coach and said, hey, I'd love to help you out on this. There's some things we could do. They would say, that's great. I know we need it, but I've just never been able to implement it myself. So I think they'd be more than happy to, more times than not, to let us help them in these cases.
Yeah, I mean, that would be great. Sometimes being an athletic trainer in a high school, all-season baseball is in the middle of the most important sport in the state of Texas, which is football season. And it really makes it tough to do those screenings, like you said. But
I think sometimes it's, well, we don't do a full team screening, but you know those guys, everybody knows who those baseball guys are and whose parents love baseball and the players are looking forward to baseball, so you probably can get some screening done on at least a handful of those guys.
Yeah, and at least work with some of the off-season, the off-season program. The baseballers that are not, and then I know my baseballers that are football players also.
Yeah.
Usually, like your star quarterback is also
your shortstop.
Your shortstop, or
well, and then we see it too. They play a football game on Friday, and they go in the baseball tournament on Saturday, Sunday, or something.
And they're working ball and stuff, select teams and
all
that. But I mean, I like the ideas of some of the things you talked about. As far as one thing I didn't get, I couldn't see the screen well. Was you talking about the GERD and the adduction part? I mean, I just couldn't see the screen with all the statistics you were throwing up there. Can you kind of?
Yeah, so on the screening, on the GERD, which stands for glenohumeral interrotation deficit, so we know it's normal for a baseball player to have loss of interrotation compared to his non-thon side. So that's just a given. And some of that happens, you know, it really just boils down to the bony adaptations, but what's the window? So if they have a greater than 13 degree loss, then that's kind of a red flag to saying, ooh, we need to do something about that guy. And so that should be on the list of remedying his interrotation deficit. And part of the good news too is a very very safe to be able to work on interrotation stretches. So very rarely are we going to have a guy who's hypermobile interrotation and posterior capsule wise that was a danger. So most all baseball players could benefit from stretching interrotation. And horizontal adduction is probably one thing I haven't got enough play lately. And to include that cross-body stretching on the stretching program, that helps remedy the GERD as well.
Yeah, because I want to see your stretches in the breakout on some of those, because I had some old ways of doing internal stretches, and that sometimes don't seem to work as well,
yeah.
Where you're trying to press on the scapula and that. But,
Ron, you talked about internal rotation deficit. Can you talk about total arc of motion real quick with that, as far as, you know, you're gonna gain a little external rotation as a thrower, lose a little internal. Can you talk about those numbers
real
quick?
That's a good point. So total rotation motion and total arc of motion, if we add internal rotation plus external rotation, we'll come up with a number, you know, somewhere around 180, 200 is kind of typical with our throwing athletes. So we add it together, and we should be very similar to the non-throwing arm. So we kind of have this this envelope of range that our shoulders go in. It just happens to be that envelope is kind of shifted in one direction with the throwing athletes. And so if your fall without, if your total motion is greater than 5 degrees different than the non-throwing arm, then that's the other red flag that the research kind of pinned down at this being kind of the threshold point. So not only look at internal rotation, but see how that adds together with their external rotation.
Because yeah, you can't, I know in medicine, you can't look at, oh, you've got bad internal rotation. Well, you could have, you know, increased external rotation, so you got a good total arc of motion that's not
right.
Too bad. You got to look at each part and the whole as well, I think, to
yeah,
look at this.
That's a good
point. I want to step back for just a second to something you talked about earlier, that, you know, baseball kind of, I guess, set the trend in that we don't know a lot still today about the shoulder. We know a bunch, but we're still way far behind our understanding of this hypermobile joint that can do crazy stuff at fast speeds. But I think growers or baseball is where we understood the kinetic chain best with that, and understanding that, you know, the hip bone's connected to the thigh bone, and all that matters. And people don't get that a blister on your finger or a sprained big toe puts a pitcher on the DL or makes them miss a start because of the stresses and everything having to work in synchronicity to let them throw without putting themselves at risk. And a lot of, even today, people don't understand, well, he just got a blister, he can't throw it there. No, he can't. You know?
Yeah, and that blister could happen for a whole lot of reasons. It could be anywhere along the body,
right.
Chain, which is really interesting.
Right. I mean, from how you're gripping the ball to you got a bad ankle, you know.
Yeah.
And so that's what, you know, even today, even as much as we know in the 24/7 news cycle of ESPN, they still don't get one. He got tendonitis from flicking sunflower seeds and he's on the DL. Yes, he is. You know, because I can't think, what is one of the stats out of Andrew's group is 25% of the salary spent on pitchers is spent for them to be on the DL, you know, and so that's significant.
Okay, so, well, you talked about a lot of things. You talked about the conditioning, you talked about lifting weights, and the old cliche that baseball players shouldn't lift weights, which is, you know,
that's been
ridiculous.
Shot down.
Yeah, it's been shot down now. And most baseball coaches do lift, but yet they, you know, I see that some of the lifts are different than like footballs, but in a way the same. You know, so you talked about the different types of lifts and players should lift. I think they should lift more in the off season and in the in season, you know, more sport specific and do the things. And you talked about being lifting in season like, you know, once or twice a week. And how yours alternate weights like once and then bands the next, you know. Can you kind of talk a little bit about what your history has said about lifting?
Yeah, so that's a good point. So I still think strength is strength, and all the benefits in strength carry over to baseball as well as it does any other sport. But we're safer than some of the things we do considering the throwing arm. So we modify bench press, we stay away from probably overhead pressing, squats, we look to see how our shoulders are postured. And just for simplicity's sake, I think, and for variety's sake, at least where we do it, we go basic dumbbell lifts on one day for the shoulder-specific strengthening, and then band lift on the other day. So it kind of helps set up the coaches, they usually set up that way too. And so it's nothing magical, but making sure we're doing some tough activation, conditioning, you know, throughout the week, and I think a couple times enough to maintain what they need to and not overtrain them along with the throwing that they're doing.
Hey, Ron, two things off the strength conditioning. Number one, can you talk about the fact that, yes, you can fatigue and overtrain the rotator cuff, that you can and mm-hmm. create an issue by trying to do good? And then to go with that, can you know, I learned it from you, and we talked about it in different ways. Talk about the 2-to-3-to-1 ratio on push-pull. a little bit for, or pull push rather, for people to understand that and what that matters.
Wow, that's good. Yeah, so definitely when you're working out, the posture imbalances that we see for all lifters it becomes that much more problematic when we're asking someone to throw. So the typical forward head, rounded shoulders, protected scapula, all plays into this anterior chest, shoulder tightness that's developed from excessive bench pressing, postural problems, bicep curls, incline press, everything we're doing for the anterior muscles, and we're not doing anything to the backside muscles. And so so we need to get a better balance. So very, very broad and general statements, we typically need to do a better job of stretching the front, strengthening the back. And so we can minimize any pressing movements and do just enough to make sure we're getting scapular type work out of it, but also work our retractors, rhomboids, middle traps, lower traps, all those things are scapular retractors and help with upper rotators and lats included. So we're working the decelerator stabilizer muscles. And the kind of adage in the baseball world is you can only throw as hard as what you can stabilize against. And so your body's not going to allow you to do something you can't control. So we got to work those control postural eccentric stabilizers probably more so on the throwing athlete.
So you're talking like the rowing actions and...
Right. So as many rows and that you can kind of come up with, so you can do dumbbell rows, seated rows, everything you're asking for. And all that, if you're talking about working the core, well, I mean, you work the core with any exercise you do, and even more so here. So we want to make sure that our athletes are getting scapular retraction, thoracic extension type stuff, and not lumbar extension. So we're working, asking for a stable lumbar segment while we're getting the extension and retraction and scapulas, you know, with our exercises.
Almost want to take care of all our coaches and make them, they have to go through many courses every year, like what I put my sports medicine 2 kids through on, you know, the muscle actions.
Yeah, exactly.
In other words, how they know, you know, if you want to work the rhomboids, well, what action does that? So these coaches, they have no clue as to...
Yes, they do. Just ask them, they'll tell you.
They know everything.
I think in most cases, we work our scapular stabilizers and core just by simply doing the exercises correctly.
Right. Yeah. Planking. Yeah.
Well, even just if you're doing a row or our prone exercises, the YTWs and Ls, that's huge core exercise if we're just asking them to stabilize and hold the posture they need to be.
Right.
Yeah, that's
you don't need
key.
Extra core exercise if you're doing exercise correctly.
The key is if they just hold that. What do they call it? Where you hold your belly button in and you're holding.
So you've got abdominal bracing.
Yeah, right. So you get that brace and hold it. Most of them, it's a posture. They sit like this instead of sitting and holding their core up. Right. So.
Ron, you talk, and I want to get to something first before this, but you talked about to ice or not to ice, and a million moms across the world are freaking right now. But let's take it a little. One step back from that, and he's got it written down over there, and I saw it a second ago. What's your thought process on what they do post pitching? Does that matter, determined by how many innings or how many pitches they threw that day? If they got bombed in 2.5 innings and they're out, do they do more work that day? Do you want them to do something, or do you say, hey, that bad outing was enough, you know? Or if they go a complete game, what do they do? You know, I mean, do you work on anything that day, the day of? Growing. You know, a lot of coaches have them go run or do those things. What's your thoughts?
I try to keep it simple and doable, so I don't think, I think you're probably overthinking it if you're saying you only threw 20 pitches and you threw 60. So I think still some type of cool down, you know, whether it be light tubing or a jog, so just a full body kind of blood flow, I think is fine enough. And then we know that pitchers tend to lose interrotation, horizontal duction, and elbow flexion after throwing. And so we go ahead and address that issue right away and stretch those muscles before we lose them.
Stretch them that day
of? Yeah, day of.
Stretch right after pitching.
Yeah.
Right.
And realistically, they could partner stretch that. They could get somebody, one of their buddies, to do that.
Yeah, they can lay on the bench.
So educate more about doing that stretching instead of concentrating more of, oh, we need to ice this shoulder and arm down right after they pitch, and then we lose that stretching, and that leads into why they're so tight the next day.
But I think if someone really felt like icing was that necessary after you talked to them, then I wouldn't stop them from icing. But I think
our message,
if say ice is the answer to everything.
Yeah, you don't want to live by the ice bag and die by the ice bag, so to speak. You need ice if you had an underlying condition, but other than that, maybe just a flush.
Yeah, I mean, if you really look at what depth we get a tissue decrease, 2 centimeters, does that go down to the shoulder joint? Not likely.
Yeah, I was going to say that's pretty much... You know, you talked. We covered a lot of things as far as you said. And I did want to. Bubba asked that one question. That was one of the questions I was going to ask about the number of animals and that. But it's been a pleasure talking to you, Ron. And I know you're one. We got to do the breakouts here pretty soon, and we have another one coming. So we want to give thanks for Ron and to Bubba, and this is Bill Hale and Jasmine running the things. A special shout out to Memorial Hermann, and thank you for allowing us to do this in the Sports Medicine Broadcast. This is a wrap.